And with me now is Michael Oakes, whose rock and roll records and photographs have become one of the most extensive rock collections in the country. His archives have been used as a source for several movies, including American Hot Wax, The Rose, and Christine, as well as for many books, magazines, and album covers. Oakes has just compiled a book of rock and roll photographs from the late 40s through 1970. It's titled Rock Archives. The book opens with T-Bone Walker doing a split while holding his guitar over his head and ends with photos of Janis Joplin and Country Joe and the Fish. In between are photos of Alan Freed's Moondog Rock and Roll Party from WJW in Cleveland, photograph of the young Elvis Presley in jeans and a denim jacket talking in a doorway to an even younger-looking Sal Mineo, who's wearing a sports jacket and tie. There's a performance shot of Little Richard where he's standing at the piano, playing with one leg thrown over the top of the keyboard. Phil Spector is pictured with the Teddy Bears, the band he performed with before he became a record producer. There's photos of the girl groups, the surfer bands, the folk revival groups, acid rock bands, and even photos of pop personalities who had hit records, like Richard Chamberlain, Patty Duke, and Anita Bryant. Michael Oakes' career in music also includes having served as promotion director for Columbia, Shelter, and ABC Records. He also managed part of the career of his late brother, Phil Oakes, who was one of the leading topical political singer-songwriters of the 1960s. Michael Oakes' new book, Rock Archives, is published by Doubleday, and I should mention, too, that he's brought with him about a dozen 45 RPMs that are very rare from his own collection, and we'll be listening to as many as we can get to. Michael Oakes, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hi, thank you. Good to be in Philly.
Why did you start collecting records and photographs? I mean, you've obviously been a very diligent collector through the years.
Well, actually, I was at the right age when rock and roll started. So I was there at the beginning. Like, I got to see Buddy Holly live in 57 at the New York Paramount. And so I always collected tons of records, but I always gave them away because we moved around a lot. And then in 1969, when I moved to California, I just came out with my 100 favorite records and tried to find one record I had when I was a kid, and I found out it was impossible, or if I could find it, it would cost a lot of money. And so I panicked and went, I want everything I had when I was a kid. And so from 69 on, I just was a fanatical collector. You know, spent every spare moment, you know, getting every record I could.
Well, as living testament to the kind of collecting you've been doing, why don't we listen to one of the records that you've brought with you today, and then we'll talk some more about your record and photograph archives. You want to introduce the first one for us and give us some background?
This is unusual. This is a protest song that was done pure pop in England. The group is called the Hedgehoppers Anonymous. Basically, Jonathan King produced and wrote the song, and it's called It's Good News Week.
Someone's dropped a bomb somewhere, contaminating atmosphere and blackening the sky. It's good news week. Someone's found a way to give the rotting dead a will to live, go on and never die. Have you heard the news? What did it say? Who's won that race? What's the weather like today? It's good news week. Lots of blood in Asia now. They butchered off the sacred cow. They've got a lot to eat. It's good news week. Doctors finding many ways of wrapping brains and metal trays to keep us from the heat. Contaminating atmosphere and blackening the sky. It's good news week. Someone found a way to give the rotting dead a will to live, go on and never die. Have you heard the news? What did it say? Who's won that race? What's the weather like today?
What's the weather like today?
It's good news week. Lots of blood in Asia now. They butchered up the sacred cow. Keep us from the heat, to keep us from the heat.
All That was Hedgehoppers Anonymous, and it's Good News Week. Michael, do you think that anyone else in the world heard that record besides you?
No, it didn't get much airplay due to the political content of the song. And in fact, Jonathan King, I don't know if it's true or not, said that the members of the group Hedgehoppers Anonymous were all ex-RAF veterans, to make it sound more patriotic. But, almost nobody played it because of the political content. So it's about time it got some airplay.
We'll be hearing some more of your records in a few minutes. Now, I think it's much more common to collect photographs than to collect records than photographs. When did you start collecting rock photographs?
About the same time, about 69, because I was working for Columbia Records as a head of publicity, and I saw them throwing away some photographs, and I went, wait a minute, I'll bet the photos will probably become as rare as the records. And I went to explain the music to people. I want to be able to explain it visually as well as orally. So I started fanatically collecting those too.
You have great photographs from the 1940s before you were born, or certainly before you were old enough to be collecting. Mm-hmm. How did you get those?
I'm always backtracking. I'm always like trying to track down original artists, looking up old booking agencies, dealing with other collectors, dealing with other writers, people like that. And basically, I just I love all forms of music, and I just love the idea of documenting it all, or to see what an Illinois jacket looked like in the 40s, that kind of stuff. And it's like, and especially stuff I never got to live through yet.
Does every period in every genre have its own style of publicity shot?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's like, their 50s stuff was a lot cornier than the 60s, say, or the 60s was more cash, or basically the bands try to be the people's bands, more accessible and less star-like, whereas in the 50s it had to be matching outfits and, a whole professional aura about it. Or in the 60s, what Barry Gordy did with his black artists, which is just make it such a complete professional unit, that was a real distinctive style. I mean, like the Supremes in these exquisite evening gowns, versus sweaters and jeans, for instance.
How do you think, how do you think that the rock and roll publicity photographs compare to, say, Hollywood studio publicity photographs from the same periods?
Basically, they were the same. I mean, like a Bruno of Hollywood would photograph both recording artists as well as movie stars. It was usually, glamour was key, especially in the early days. It was like you had to be really good looking. It wasn't until the 60s where ugly became in.
One of my favorite shots in there is of Elvis Presley and Sal Mineo, both very young, talking to each other in a doorway. What are some of your favorites that you have in
the collection? That's pretty up there, because nothing defies 50s punk as well as that photo does. So it's like, whoa. I mean, especially the way they're eyeing each other as to who's cooler, Yeah, that's hot. I love that shot of Smokey Robinson with the Temptations. A friend of mine shot that, and he used to hang out at the Apollo every night. And in fact, he hung out with the Temptations so much they called him the Fifth Temptation. And he was backstage at the Apollo with the Temps. And Smokey sent word from his dressing room saying that he had just written a new song that he wanted the Temps to hear. And that photo is the photo shows Smokey singing My Girl to the Temptations for the first time ever. And for something that momentous to have been captured on film is just amazing to me.
We listen to another one of the records that you brought with you, and my guest is Michael Oakes, who has an enormous archives of both rock and roll records and photographs. A new book of his photographs have been published called Rock Archives, and we're listening today to some of his rare recordings from his record collection, and the next one is by Dion.
Okay, this was the B-side of Abraham, Martin, and John. It's an old folk tune called Daddy Rollin', and Dion, was possibly the best white male singer from the 50s and the 60s, And this is my favorite obscure record of Dion's. I mean, this is the best singing I've heard him do.
Okay, let's hear it.
Can't stand to leave you be, baby. Like a stone.
That was Dion from the flip side of his hit record, Abraham, Martin, and John. And I'll confess to you, Michael, that I never really liked the hit side very very much, but I really liked that flip side quite a bit.
He was with a few male teen idols with real guts. I mean, it's like, that voice on that record is just one of a kind.
What happened to Dion? You know, because he's kind of went out of sight for a while, then did Abraham, Martin, and John, and now I think has resurfaced as a singer of Christian music.
Yeah, he's been born again. Basically, he had a very bad drug problem throughout his career and kept trying comebacks over the years, and they never quite made it. And now he's become born again. He's putting out Christian albums that are amazing. He's still singing as good as ever, and it's just they are great records, even though it is a different genre.
Are they original songs or are they gospels?
Some are original and some are. I think the good percentage of them are original, actually. Yeah, he's quite a decent writer.
Is it on a Christian label that he's recording?
Yeah, I can't remember the label, but yeah, it is one of those Christian labels. Yeah,
and you're collecting all his Christian records as well.
When I can, yeah, I just got one. I think there's about three now. I only have one of the three, and I was amazed how good it was.
Do you think this happened to a lot of rock performers from the 50s and 60s that they've had a lot of troubles, become born again, and are now doing religious music?
I think it's a real cycle. It's like when you become a superstar, you tend to lose all your values, and usually they turn to drugs first to find something else. When that doesn't work, then they get into some religious thing, and if that doesn't work, then they marry some strong woman and get back to the womb, basically. And it happens quite a bit.
Your photo archives have been used for several movies, mm-hmm. including Christine, The Rose, and American.
Well, Christine, actually, I did all the music for Christine.
You chose all the records?
Yeah.
Let's talk about that. That was really fun, because for our listeners who didn't see it, Christine is about a kind of possessed demonic car, and every time somebody walks in, the radio starts playing a song whose lyrics have to do with the way the car feels toward that person. You want to give us some examples of songs that you chose and why for it?
I had so much fun with that, but I think primarily because both Stephen King and the director John Carpenter know music backwards and forwards as well as I do, probably.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and it's so much easier to work with somebody who knows the genre. And so, the good thing about John Carpenter was when I would come up with an idea, I would never have to explain it to him. He would either like it or not. And the one of my favorite things in the movie is the opening scene. It starts with a flashback to 57 where they're building the car, and then it segues to California 20 years later. And so I needed a song that was a hit in 57 and in 78. And so I went through all my research books and found two songs, Come Go With Me by the Del Vikings and then by the Beach Boys, and Not Fade Away by Buddy Holly and then by Tanya Tucker. And so I chose Not Fade Away primarily, and I told John Carpenter this. I said, it has to be the line, my love's bigger than a Cadillac. I try to show it and you're driving me back. And John did it exactly the way I suggested it. And it's like sort of an inside joke because there's a Plymouth there and they're singing about a Cadillac. So I love that.
What other songs did you choose for it?
When Arnie, the main character's friend, is trying to get into the car, and the car yells at him, "Keep a knocking, but you can't come in." Little Richard. And my favorite scene in the whole movie is when Christine finally kills somebody for the first time. It starts out with the kids walking down the dark, deserted street, and I use Thurston Harris's Little Bitty Pretty One. So you hear that do 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 do. And then all of a sudden the lights come on in Christine and they refract through this gorgeous dark blue night. And then the music builds as the car picks up speed and kills the kid. And it's the perfect mixture of music and film, I thought.
What balance did you want to keep between records that everyone would know but records that wouldn't be really obvious? Because there's some records that everybody thinks of immediately, and mm-hmm. those are probably too obvious to use, right?
It's a weird balance. I mean, you can't do the obvious, and yet you can't get too eclectic either because you have to establish the time and the feel. And so basically what I would do is, it's really funny because it's always the first thing that pops into my mind that usually ends up staying in the movie. Or like, for instance, I used Dion, in fact, on when the owner of the car, Arnie, realizes that the car hates the idea he has a girlfriend because the car wants all of his love, as he's driving away from his girlfriend, then he realizes he's not gonna be able to see her again because the car is too jealous. I put on I Wonder Why I Love You Like I Do, by Dion and the Belmonts. And so there's a lot of subtle humor throughout the movie with the music.
That's great. What about for the Rose? What did you do for that?
The Rose, I just did a set decoration. In the opening scene with the garage where the parents have an altar to the dead girl and they take the reporter into the garage, they needed like 15 years of nostalgia to cover the walls. And so I covered the walls with photos and magazine covers and stuff like that.
And American Hot Wax.
I worked closely with Kenny Vance, basically recreating Alan Freed's office, recreating posters, for the office, and finding the right records, and helping out on mixing the soundtrack album. It's just about everything in that movie.
And Casey Kasem hosts a show in which he does a countdown. I forget if it's the top 10 or 100.
The America's Top 10, yes.
Yeah. And I know that you've been a consultant for that. What do you do?
I just supply all the visuals. I don't do any of the writing for the Casey Kasem show.
Uh-huh.
But like if he has a trivia question, like who are the first twins to have a top 10 record, and the answer is the Kalin twins, you'll need a picture of the Kalin twins, and I'm probably the only one in the country that would have it.
Do you know all the answers to the trivia questions too?
Actually, yes.
Did you used to love countdowns when you were young, listening to the radio?
Oh, I used to love it. We used to copy them down off the radio. In fact, I remember one time we were driving somewhere and I had to borrow my sister's jigsaw puzzle box because that was the only thing I could find to write on. To write down the top 40 as they were counting it down.
I remember New Year's Eve being a great night for that. New Year's Eve, they do
for the year.
The top 100 of the whole year,
right.
And that would be a terrific night.
Oh, yeah.
And you'd always try to guess what was going to be number one, but though you probably calculated throughout the year and already knew what was going to be the top 10, right?
No, not really. No, no. It's more like I'd always be shocked. I'd go, oh, you mean that piece of garbage was that big? and why isn't my favorite record in there?
My guest is Michael Oakes, who has an incredibly extensive archives of both rock and roll records and photographs, and he's just compiled a book of excerpts of his photograph collection, but he's brought with him today to Fresh Air some of his favorite records, 45s that are reasonably obscure or rare from his record collection. And well, why don't we listen to the next one that you brought? You want to introduce it?
Yeah, this was recently voted the world's worst record ever.
Hey, thanks for bringing it, Michael.
Hey, sure, my pleasure. the artist is a guy named Jimmy Cross, and the basic premise is this guy goes to a Beatles concert, and we'll take it from there. It's called I Want My Baby Back.
Hardly know where to begin. I remember we were cruising home from a Beatles concert. I'd had such a wonderful evening sitting there watching my baby screaming and tearing her hair out and carrying on. She was so full of life then. Well, we were about 3 miles from home when all of a sudden it started to rain. And I do mean rain. I couldn't hardly see nothing. Well, we kept driving for about another mile when all of a sudden I see this stalled car right smack in front of me. Well, I wasn't about to slam on the brakes because it didn't have none to start with. So I swerved to the left, and what do I see? Some mush head on a motorcycle heading right at us. And I knew at last, me and my baby were about to meet the leader of the... pack. Well, when I come to, I looked around, and there was the leader, and there was the pack, and over there was my baby, and over there was my baby, and way over there was my baby. I want my baby back. It's been many months now since that fateful night, and you know something, I've tried. Believe me, I have tried, but I just can't make it without my baby. So, I've decided I'm gonna have her back one way or another. Oh, baby, I dig you so much. Hot dang pay dirt. Yeah.
Yeah, sort of an underground classic, so to say.
That's probably another example of a record that no one has ever heard.
Nope, you got it.
But now, how did you find that? Had you heard it somewhere?
No, it wasn't airplay. I find a lot of records. You know, people give me whole collections at times. And so the thing I love is finding stuff that you know nothing about and you just put it on because of the title or something about the record that strikes you as interesting. That was on Tolly Records, which was the same label that the Beatles' first stuff was on. So I figured anything on Tolly is worth checking. And boy, was it ever worth checking.
There's a whole genre of having your girlfriend killed in an accidental car crash and
there's a whole genre of underage death. Mm-hmm. You know, in fact, I did a whole chapter of that on the book, you know, about the, you know, all the suicide songs or songs about, you know, the teen tragedies. Yep.
Did you like the regular songs like that?
I found them incredibly corny at the time, and yet they're hysterical now in retrospect. You know, I mean, I always love a good sense of humor.
My guest is Michael Oakes, who has a very extensive archives of rock and roll records and rock photographs, and a book of his rock photographs has been published. These are photographs from his collection, and the book is called Rock Archives. And we'll be hearing more of some of the records that he's brought with him in a little while. You spent, several years heading up the promotion companies of different record companies, including Columbia.
Yeah, actually publicity departments, yes.
What's the difference between publicity and promotion?
Promotion is mostly radio stations, you know, getting the records played, whereas publicity is dealing with writers and getting people to write about the records.
I see. So what years were you doing that?
Basically 69 till 77. Yeah.
Who are some of the artists who you were working with then who it was a pleasure to call people up and say, why don't you write about them?
Oh, the Firesign Theater. They were such great guys, and it was like it became a real cult, you know, item. That was fun. It was fun working with Janis Joplin. The Birds. I love helping them with their comeback. The most fun I had, in fact, the last record company job I ever had was with ABC Records. And they signed this guy named Freddie Fender, who did Before the Next Teardrop Falls. And they told me not to work the record because, you know, it's a 40-year-old Chicano and it's half in Spanish, and how could it possibly sell? And I said, I know it's a hit. And so I worked real hard and basically single-handedly broke the record. And got fired over because the Freddie became so big. He was actually the biggest artist on ABC. He sold more than Jimmy Buffett and Steely Dan put together. And rather than being rewarded, everybody resented that. So I got fired, and that's when I decided that no more record company jobs. Time to work for myself. Yeah.
In fact,
Freddie gave me a gold record saying, "Thanks, brother. Without you, it wouldn't have been possible."
Well, why do you think you got fired for making
a
big people?
It was the industry was changing. When I first got into the record industry, they hired us, quote, house hippies, you know, because we loved the music so much and we would do anything to get it, you know, to get attention on the stuff we loved. And they had no idea how we worked, but they knew we got results. And so it was like, those were the fun days where we could just get away with murder and do whatever it took, you know, to get the records played. And then it became more and more corporate, and then became more and more prostituted too. It became, playlists got tighter and tighter. FM basically died, became the same as AM. And it became a game where it took cocaine to get records played, and a lot of us would not play that game. And so, you know, we wanted people to listen to us because the records were good, not because we were giving them drugs.
You mean writers and disc jockeys wanted drugs?
Everybody, yes, yes. I mean, it's that way today. It's really gotten ugly. Yeah, there are a few promotion companies that are really controlling the whole industry, and at some point it should come out.
You think they're doing that through the use of drugs? I mean,
drugs have replaced money and women as bribes, yes. Yeah, it's totally a cocaine industry now, and frankly, I hate it.
What were the first signs of the record industry becoming more corporate in rock and roll?
I think it's basically when it fell apart after Saturday Night Fever made everybody too greedy. When a record like Saturday Night Fever could sell faster than they could produce the records, I mean, everybody got very, very greedy, and they went, okay, well, let's ship everything platinum. Let's ship out millions of copies of everything. And then they lost it. The records came back in returns just as fast. And so the whole industry sort of like fell apart at that point. And then at the same time, you had home taping going on where the kids, I think the kids were ripped off too many times. And the kids would not risk $7.98 for something unknown. And so they would wait till somebody else bought it, and then they would just tape a copy. And so record sales just really tailed off quickly. And when that happens, they figure, okay, get rid of the creative types and bring in the accountants and the lawyers. And then the lawyers, and right now it's pretty much run by accountants and lawyers. still.
Did you ever go through periods where you had to promote people whose work you thought was pretty terrible?
Now, that was the fun of when I got into it. It was like, I mean, you could really be a brat and go, you know, and not work certain acts because you knew they were rubbish, and spend your time more effectively and stuff you know you could get results on. I mean, the advantage of those days were, I mean, you would get fired easier if you were wrong, but at least you had the opportunity to make those mistakes. You know, whereas now, and now I hear tell, it's like, you know, you do what you're told, and that's why I'm no longer in that industry.
Mm-hmm. So you started, you know, like, just wanting to work really hard because you loved it, and then...
Yeah, because it's like it's just like sharing the music, just like I tried to do with this book. It's like sharing this stuff. It's not like a, you know, I mean, people should be aware of this. People should enjoy this stuff. And I could never push something on the public that I didn't believe in, no.
How do you think videos have changed the record industry and have changed promotion?
I think it's hurting it, frankly. Basically, the ante has gotten too high for a lot of people to get into the business. So your average kid wants to be a musician. But, I mean, the buy-in is so high now. I mean, you can't get there without a video of your own and without this and without that. And also, I don't like the idea of the videos in general. If they're done well, they're great. I mean, it's great to have music visual, you know, as well as the audio part of it. But it's like the bulk of the videos are they tend to limit the songs. I mean, when you grew up with a song, you had your own interpretation of it, your own image of it. It's like who were you going with when that song was popular, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas now, I mean, you see all these exquisite-looking women that are just sex objects, you know, and it's like I think it's way too limiting.
The videos are made through the promotion budget of the band. Do you think mm-hmm. that limits the amount of touring that they can do, since that probably comes in part out of the promotion budget as well?
No, I think it was designed to make up for the lack of touring, because it's gotten so expensive to tour that groups like The Who have to be subsidized by beer companies and stuff. You know, it's really embarrassing to think that a major group can't go out without being subsidized by another product. You know, it's a very strange concept for me. It seems like the music has to be usurped to a good degree. And you know, I never liked that at all. And plus, the venues are getting smaller and smaller. It just seems like, you know, the business of live music is not what it used to be. I mean, it's not what it was in the 60s or even the 70s.
Do you still consider yourself to be in the business?
Yeah, sort of as a maverick, yes. Yeah, I've always been a gadfly of sorts, you know. Basically, I will never leave music. You know, I love music. I'll always do something with music. And what I did by creating the archives was find a way that I can do what I really feel is important with music. And the good thing is I'm finally getting industry support. I mean, this was a one-man crusade for years and years. But just recently, like MCA Records gave me all of their photo files, because basically they did not know what to do with it themselves. You know, so they just turned them over to me and stuff. And I'm now like I'm one of 92 experts in the country that votes for who gets into the Hall of Fame for the Grammys.
Who'd you vote for?
Last year?
Yeah.
I can't remember. I honestly can't remember.
It means that much to you, huh?
No, I vote, and but there's like 92 of us. So I mean, it's like voting for Mondale, you know.
You have approached some photographers, right? One named Jack Kriegsman, is that his name?
Oh, James Kriegsman, yes.
Yeah. Do you want to tell the story of his photographs and how you hooked up with him?
Oh, this is, I was, basically, you know, I always, you know, circulate these photos around, and this is one classic photo of this artist named Ursel Hickey, who had one minor hit called Bluebirds Over the Mountain, that to me was the atypical rock and roll photo of all times. And so I used that in about 3 movies and in about 5 different books. And one day I got a call from Ursel Hickey saying, I've been trying to find you for 3 years. I just want to thank you, man. Because if you gain that photograph everywhere, I've got a whole new career. And yeah, I'm recording again. I'm touring with the Beach Boys, et cetera, et cetera. And whenever you come to New York, I'd love to meet you. So I came to New York to do the book, and Ursel wanted to get together. And he lives in New Jersey now, and I had no time to see him. So I called him up. I called him up to get out of it, and I said, "Look, the only time I have open is Wednesday afternoon. I won't have time to go to Jersey." And he said, "Look, I'll be in the city anyway. I'll be seeing James Kriegsman. Why don't we meet there?" And I said, "James Jr.?" He said, "No, James Sr. The old man was still alive." And this is the guy that basically James started in 1932 with Sinatra, and he's photographed every major artist from Sinatra up to the present. And he had the biggest photo studio in New York. It's like on 46th, right off of 7th Avenue. And it's like the logo, the big K in the corner. You know, I've seen that logo for years, and you know, I thought for sure the guy was gone. So I met Ursel there and met James Kriegsman, and Kriegsman was just such a godsend. I mean, he really improved the book. I mean, I'm the first person in 50 years who's gotten to go through all of his files, and he gave me a whole bunch of stuff for the book, and now I even represent him, and I'm trying to, I think the next book will be on James Kriegsman. I'd like to do a 50-year retrospective on him.
So who are some of the people who he's photographed?
Oh, he photographed Simon and Garfunkel when they were Tom and Jerry, Levon and the Hawks before they became the band. He photographed all the Motown acts. He was basically the house photographer for Motown and for Stax Records. Bill Haley, Buddy Holly, Ray Charles. I mean, you name it. It goes on and on and on. Yeah.
What does he think of the value of those photographs?
He didn't think they were valuable. You know, when I walked in there, I said, James, you're sitting on a gold mine. He said, only if you know how to mine it, Michael. I said, I do. He said, well, do it.
Okay, my guest is Michael Oakes, who has an archives of rock and roll photographs and records, and a book called Rock Archives has just been published of some of the photographs from his collection. He's also brought with him today a dozen 45s that he says are pretty rare or very unusual. Several of these have seldom been heard by anybody.
And there's a good reason.
That's right. The last one he announced is one of the worst records ever. And what do we have up next?
This one is pretty absurd. This was it's a record called I'm Normal by the Emperor. And it basically was they tried to make a follow-up to They're Coming to Take Me Away by Napoleon XIV. That one got airplay. This one didn't.
Okay, let's hear it.
Hey, come and take my brother away. The men in white picked him up yesterday, but they'll never come take me away, because I'm okay. I'm normal. I painted everything in my house purple, my fingernail file, my potato peelers, my... Stay away from my frog! I got an earthworm in a fruit jar, and I make long-distance calls to Ringo Starr, and I make funny faces to scare the kids. Boo! Save lightning bugs and katydids. They'll never come take me away, because I'm normal. I'm okay. I play tiddlywinks with Dracula's bat and jump rope with a cross-eyed cat. I play Bob Dylan records upside down and keep my fish out of water so they won't drown. My brother didn't know them things. That's the reason they took him away. Took him away yesterday. He's crazy, but I'm okay. I fill my bathtub with strawberry jam and feed my squirrels sugar-cured ham. And I spread rumors that Stalin is dead. I said he was wearing a sheepskin when he died in bed. Made that up. I eat alphabet soup with a tuning fork and shine my shoes with Chinese pork. I'm okay. They'll never take me away. I'm normal. You show me a pig on the highway and I'll show you a road dog. Step on the crack and break your mother's back. I play the violin with just my thumbs and feed my lizard waffle crumbs. And I throw stones at telephone poles and hide mothballs and gopher holes. I teach my bulldog to wear sunglasses and drink champagne and dance with Indians to make it rain. They'll never come take me away, cause I'm normal. I draw mustaches on Playboy bunnies and light bonfires with Sunday funnies. And my cellar's full of Japanese spies, and I've got a red wagon with wings that flies. I change into a werewolf after dark and chase the pigeons in the park. I soak my feet in cranberry sauce and call my parakeet Betsy Ross. I'm normal, they'll never take me away. They took my brother away yesterday. He's a babbling idiot, he is.
Well, that was The Emperor, and a novelty recording brought by my guest today, Michael Oakes, who has a very extensive rock and roll record and rock and roll photograph collection. Did you like a lot of novelty songs when you were listening to pop radio all the time?
Not really. I mean, they would get through to you the fastest because they were so unusual, but you would get tired of them the quickest also. The thing I love about this stuff is I love weird experimentation. I love things that, you know, just have not been done before. And so the ones I brought today are just, you know, just the real archetypes, you know, of that genre.
Where did you grow up, New York?
I grew up all over the country. Born in Texas, raised about half and half between New York and Ohio. Yeah, I grew up in New York three times, yes.
If it's okay, I'd like to talk with you a little bit about your brother, Phil Oakes,
sure.
whose career I know that you managed for a while. Did he share your passion for rock and roll?
Yeah, actually, when we were kids, he liked classical and country, and I liked all the black stuff. I liked the R&B stuff and the blues, and we agreed on Presley. Yeah, and then we both loved Presley. And then from then on out, we both loved rock and roll.
There were a lot of, like, music wars in the house?
Not really, no. We basically turned each other on to the stuff that we had heard that the other one hadn't heard. Yeah, there was no competition on music.
How politically involved was he?
He was he was totally politically involved, whereas I wasn't. Yeah.
Was that a source of tension between the two of you?
No, not really. I believed in teaching by example, and he was he always believed in doing things larger than life. He always wanted to be a star and be bigger than life, and I just like life.
Yeah. Did he ever feel upstaged by Bob Dylan? Because they started servicing at about the same time, and was there ever any stated or unstated competition between them?
No, Phil wanted to be as good and as big as Dylan. He was always an admirer of Dylan and always a supporter of Dylan. For instance, like when everybody attacked Dylan for leaving folk music to go electric, when all these attacks came out, Phil did a lot of articles in various publications, you know, saying that Dylan was making great music and had every right in the world to do whatever he felt was right musically. The only argument they really had, they were friends up until the point of Blonde on Blonde, and Phil and Dylan were going, I think they were going to a movie or something, and they're in the cab, and Dylan asked Phil what he thought of Blonde on Blonde, and Phil was always honest to a fault, and he said that he thought some of it was some of the best stuff Dylan had ever done, but he thought the bulk of it was filler, and Dylan threw him out of the cab, and they didn't speak for 10 years. Dylan could not take criticism well.
Phil Oakes was criticized when he started using electric instruments. And what did you think of that whole controversy of, like, is it okay for a purist or a folk musician to use electric instruments? Did you think that was a real issue or a non-issue?
I thought it was absurd. I thought it was a total non-issue. I think the music speaks for itself. Either it's going to make it or not make it. And every artist has the right to do what he feels is right, period. You know, I mean, it's not for the public to dictate what an artist should do. Like, can you imagine telling Picasso what he should paint? You know, silly. You know, and I just, there were too many purists. I mean, there's always, I guess the love of music is so fanatical for certain people that they can't stand to see a change, you know. You know, be it reggae, be it rock and roll, be it classical.
Well, he went through a period of completely changing. I mean, after being the leading kind of protest singer-songwriter of the period, he started wearing gold lamé suits when he was performing.
Yeah.
And that really, like, flipped out a lot of his fans and listeners. Can you talk a little bit about what was going on in his own mind when he made that change?
Well, I was against that change. Basically, I didn't think it made it musically, and I thought the idea he had was correct, but I thought the idea was better than the execution of the idea. I mean, the idea was that to get any real change in this country, to get any form of real revolutionary type stuff going, what you needed was the beauty of an Elvis Presley with the mind of a Che Guevara. And if you could ever get Presley to come out against Nixon, I mean, that would be 10 times heavier than Phil and Jerry Rubin, everybody doing it themselves. If you get somebody that was had that strong of an image to come out against Nixon, that would mean, you know, 100 times more. And so that's what he tried to pull off by doing the gold suit concert. Yeah, that he'd be in a gold suit and making fun of himself, and at the same time saying that, yeah, wouldn't it be great if Presley would become political?
Why were you opposed to that?
I didn't think it worked musically. Basically, it's like I couldn't see Phil singing Buddy Holly or Phil singing Elvis Presley songs. You know, I thought he was an excellent stylist and had a really good voice for what he did, but to do something that had already been done perfectly seemed redundant to me.
Do you think that the political content of his songs, because he wrote songs about avoiding the draft, he wrote songs about the assassination of political leaders, he wrote songs about the Marines being dispatched to Santo Domingo,
right.
Not something that was really going to endear you to probably even the mass media or the American mainstream. Do you think that the political content of his songs held back his performing possibilities? Was he ever on anything like a blacklist?
Rumor has it, yes. Phil got very little TV exposure and very little airplay. But the thing that made him great was the fact that he stuck to it, and he did do that. And the thing that's amazing to me is that his records sold as well as they did, and the fact that he could sell out Carnegie Hall in a couple of days without any airplay, primarily on the strength of what he was singing. And I thought that was great that he could pull it off without the media, you know, with the media. And I don't know if it was a blacklist or what, but without any media support, that he got as big as he got is just amazing to me. You know, and important. And the stuff is as topical as it was. I believe the stuff still holds up. I mean, you can listen to the Santo Domingo song and apply it to Central America. You know, and the other thing that Phil was excellent at was writing cinematically. I mean, his lyrics were so cinematic that you can really picture everything he's singing about so vividly. You know, that to me was his real forte.
He had some problems with his vocal cords. What happened with that? Was it an accident?
Yeah, when he turned 30, he decided that all he really wanted to do was to see the world, and so he took every opportunity he could to travel. And when he was in South Africa, he was watching a sunset by some deserted dock, and two locals jumped him and strangled him to steal his wallet and his watch, and they bent his vocal cords out of shape, and basically Phil lost, you know, a bunch of high notes. You know that he could no longer hit the high notes after that.
Was that all that affected in his singing?
Yeah, basically the high notes, yeah, more than anything, yes.
Was that very depressing for him?
Yeah, he hated it, yeah, because basically, really limited, you know, his art, yeah.
He took his own life. Do you think that physical limitation had something to do with his depression?
No, I think primarily it was because of the fact that he wasn't writing for a couple of years, and also that he'd gone through a real manic binge before that. And he thought he had been so ugly that he had negated everything he had stood for before. And I know in speaking to him in those last months, he had no opinion. I mean, he had lost his confidence, and he had no opinions about anything. And for somebody as opinionated as my brother was, I mean, he just couldn't face it. And it's always peaks and valleys, and he just couldn't see the peaks. All he could see was the valley.
There's a movie that's been done about his life. Did you work on that?
No.
What do you think of the movie?
I'm disappointed in it, frankly. I think it should have been just a documentary. I don't think it works as a docudrama. Yeah, you know, I think the person who plays Phil is not very believable. I think there are parts of it that are good, but as a whole, no. Yeah, I mean, there will be a full length theatrical feature within the next 2 or 3 years.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I'm organizing that now. Yeah.
So that's like with actors, not a documentary.
No, the full tilt. Yeah.
Do you know who's going to play him?
We can't talk about that yet.
Do you know who's going to play you?
It's a major name.
Really?
That's been there have been suggestions for who plays me too, but I don't know yet. it's coming. We're just putting the pieces together now. I think the time is right now.
Who are you working with on it?
Not at liberty to say.
Oh, okay. It's
just too soon, because if you talk about it this soon, it'll be like, you know, 2 years before it's done, and it just, you know, to have talk going now just doesn't help the project at all.
Okay.
Well, and I waited this long because, you know, I figured that I'd rather have no movie on Phil than a bad movie, and now the elements that are involved look very good.
Okay.
And well, I think the time is right with horrible Ronald Reagan. I think it's more needed now than ever.
Okay, it'll be interesting to. Just see the movie, even though you won't tell us anything about it now. But why don't we listen to...
Tune in 2 years.
Why don't we listen to one of Phil Oak's recordings, and we'll hear the draft are direct.
Okay.
Oh, I'm just a typical American boy from a typical American town. I believe in God and Senator Dodd, and I keep an old Castro down. And when it came my time to serve, I knew better dead than red. But when I got to my old draft board, buddy, this is what I said. Sarge, I'm only 18, I got a ruptured spleen, and I always carry a purse. I've got eyes like a bat, and my feet are flat, and my asthma's getting worse. Yes, think of my career, my sweetheart dear, my poor old invalid aunt. Besides, I ain't no fool, I'm a-going to school, and I'm a-working in a defense plant. I got a dislocated disc and a racked up back. I'm allergic to flowers and bugs. And when the bombshell hits, I get epileptic fits, and I'm addicted to 1,000 drugs. I got the weakness woes, I can't touch my toes, I can hardly reach my knees. And if the enemy came close to me, oh, I'd probably start to sneeze. I'm only 18, got a ruptured spleen, and I always carry a purse. I've got eyes like a bat, and my feet are flat, and my asthma's getting worse. Yes, think of my career, my sweetheart dear, my poor old invalid aunt. Besides, I ain't no fool, I'm a-going to school, and I'm a-working in a defense plant. Ooh, I hate showing lie, and I hope he dies. But one thing you gotta see, that someone's gotta go over there, and that someone isn't me. So I wish you well, Sarge, give him hell. Kill me 1,000 or so, and if you ever get a war without blood and gore, I'll be the first to go. Yes, I'm only 18, I got a ruptured spleen, and I always carry a purse. I've got eyes like a bat, and my feet are flat, and my asthma's getting worse. Yes, think of my career, my sweetheart dear, my poor old invalid aunt. Besides, I ain't no fool, I'm going to school, and I'm working in a defense plant.
That was Phil Oakes, and with me is Michael Oakes. He and Phil Oakes were brothers. And
Our brothers.
And there's a movie in the works about Phil Oakes that Michael Oakes will be working on. Michael Oakes is with us today on the occasion of the publication of his new book, Rock Archives, which features rock and roll photographs from his collection. Since you're working on this movie about yourself and your late brother Phil Oakes, mm-hmm. I'm wondering what some of your favorite music biography films are. There's been so many. So many of them are bad. Some of them are really great.
They've all been flawed. I mean, like, the first half of the Buddy Holly movie was brilliant, and then I thought it tapered off in the second half. The Idolmaker, again, the first half was just one of the best things I've ever seen, and again, it tapered off. Probably the most fully realized music movie is Coal Miner's Daughter with Sissy Spacek. I would say that would be the most complete one of all of them. The bulk of them, the stuff like Flashdance and Footloose is just, you know.
Well, those are music movies. They're not based on real people.
Right.
Would you like to see whoever gets the role of your late brother Phil Oakes actually do the performing? Because that's a real big split in music bios, and some of them the star actually performs, and in others it's.
I think it really should be. Like what Duvall did with Tender Mercies was so good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it should be that. Yeah, the performer should do it, yes. Yeah.
Okay, is it going to be awkward for you to have someone playing you on screen?
Yes, very strange, because I always want to be behind the cameras, never in front. It's very weird, and I always kept my private life private. It's going to be very weird to have that documented on a big screen. It's just, yeah, it's a very strange concept.
Are you going to allow everything to be told, or are there some things that you're going to tell the scriptwriter to keep out because it's too personal?
No, there'll be no limitations. There's certain things I want to push, basically the fact that I consider my brother was a winner, not a loser. You know, that I think what he pulled off, I mean, definitely ended the war earlier to some degree. And I think the work he left behind is really important. I mean, it's like what I did with Rock Archives. I mean, it's like everybody who made great music, I try to squeeze into this one book. I mean, there's 1,100 photos in this book. And I think it's really important that, I mean, the problem is everything goes so quickly these days that, you know, I mean, as the typical example being those interviews in England recently where the kids were surprised that Paul McCartney was in a group before Wings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that's awesome to think about. And what I wanted was to, to ensure rock and roll immortality for everybody with this book. And to put it all in the proper perspective, and same with the movie on my brother. And, yeah, I want to put it in the proper perspective as to what it was like when you could quit college because they wouldn't let you write what you wanted to write because it was too left wing, and find another medium such as folk singing, which he did, and to actually go out there and to make it as big and as important as he did.
I know you managed his career for a while. Did you like his music? Because it's not really what you're obsessed with all your life, which is rock and roll.
No, I'm not just obsessed with rock and roll. Rock and roll is my first love. But I loved folk music. I love classical music. I like jazz. I like reggae. I like the blues. Country is like real close to rock and roll to me. There's so much of it. You know, it's like I love all music. Yeah, rock and roll is the forte of the collection. But yeah, I love all music. As long as it's distinctive. And Phil was definitely distinctive. Distinctive and creative and, fun to listen to. And Phil's stuff, as heavy as it was politically, it was always very musical.
You mentioned before that you grew up in several different cities. Did you find the music scene on the radio different from city to city? There were still regional hits in those days.
To a degree.
And disc jockeys had different styles, I think, in different parts of the country, too.
Yeah, that was true, but I was such a fanatic that I would, like, hit all the jukebox companies and find stuff that never got airplay. For instance, I remember as a kid getting records like Jailbait by Andrew Williams. I said, well, anything that's called Jailbait has to be interesting, you know? So we'd find all kinds of stuff like that would never get airplay. Yeah, I never relied on airplay because that was too limited to me. Yeah, I want to hear everything that was ever produced.
Did you have any favorite disc jockeys?
My favorite of all times probably was Alan Freed, primarily because he turned me on to all the black original versions before they were covered by the white artists.
Was there ever a period where you wanted to perform yourself?
Never. In fact, my first ambition as a kid, I remember, was I wanted to be a comedy writer, not a comedian. Yeah, no, I never wanted to be a star. No. The price of stardom is far too high.
Let's get in another record that you've brought with you from your collection.
Okay, well, speaking of the black originators being covered by the white artists, this is the original version of Go Now that the Moody Blues had their first hit with, and this is where they got it from the record by Bessie Banks.
We've already said
original recording of Go Now with Bessie Banks. Do you know much about her?
No, the only thing I know is I always wanted to find out if the Moody Blues definitely got the song from this record. So I talked to their manager, Tony Seconda, and he said, yeah, he was over here in business, and somebody played him the record, and he raced back to England and played it for him, and they cut it within a week. Yep.
What do you listen to when you're home and have some time?
I listen to everything. It's like it's really funny the way my mind works. It just goes on these silly tangents, and after I play things together, and yeah, I can't understand why I would play this folk cut next to this rock cut next to this jazz cut. And after I do it, I go, oh, I see the tie-in. It's either the lyrics or a rhythmic thing or something. And it's like every time I play records, like some people play instruments. I mean, it always is amazing. It's almost like a jam. I have no idea where it's going to go. I set out to play one thing, and then all of a sudden, it's like 20 cuts later, and it just goes everywhere.
You were a rock and roll disc jockey for a short time, weren't you?
Yeah. No, actually, I was a jazz disc jockey. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. This is Michael Oakes, the show to wind up your day or wind it down, as the case may be. It was an FM show.
Do you feel left behind by any rock and roll now?
No, not at all. I keep up with everything. Yeah, I try and hear every record that comes out.
What are some of the records now that you're enjoying?
I've been a little bit behind because of promoting this book, but I love Little Steven and the Disciples. Tina Turner's new record is just incredible. I like the Eurythmics a lot. Boy, it's hard to remember. I've been living in the past for the last 3 months, so it's hard to remember the current stuff.
Right. Okay, it's been a lot of fun to meet you.
Alrighty, ditto.
And I want to thank you for being here this afternoon.
Surely.
And for bringing your records with you.
Thanks. I just tell everybody to buy Rock Archives, the book.